Side 7. Good Omens, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch, by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Continuing on page 224. Yes, said Haster, and then he smiled. His teeth were too sharp, and his tongue flickered between them. Do you? Crowley said nothing. Plan A had worked. Plan B had failed. Everything depended on Plan C. And there was one drawback to this. He had only ever planned as far as B. So, hissed Haster. Time to go, Crowley. I think there's something you ought to know, said Crowley, stalling for time. And that is? Smiled Haster. Then the phone on Crowley's desk rang. He picked it up and warned Haster. Don't move. There's something very important you should know, and I really mean it. Hello? Ng, said Crowley. Then he said, Nah, got an old friend here. Azrael hung up on him. Crowley wondered what he had wanted. And suddenly Plan C was there in his head. He didn't replace the handset on the receiver. Instead, he said, Okay, Haster, you've passed the test. You're ready to start playing with the big boys. Have you gone mad? Nope. Don't you understand? This was a test. The Lords of Hell had to know that you were trustworthy before we gave you command of the Legions of the Damned in the war ahead. Crowley, you are lying, or you are insane, or possibly you are both, said Haster. But his certainty was shaken. Just for a moment, he had entertained the possibility. That was where Crowley had got him. It was just possible that Hell was testing him, that Crowley was more than he seemed. Haster was paranoid, which was simply a sensible and well-adjusted reaction to living in Hell, where they really were all out to get you. Crowley began to dial a number. "'S okay, Duke Haster. I wouldn't expect you to believe it from me, he admitted. But why don't we talk to the Dark Council? I am sure that they can convince you. The number he had dialed clicked and started to ring. So long, sucker, he said, and vanished. In a tiny fraction of a second, Haster was gone as well. Over the years, a huge number of theological man-hours have been spent debating the famous question, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? In order to arrive at an answer, the following facts must be taken into consideration. Firstly, angels simply don't dance. It's one of the distinguishing characteristics that marks an angel. They may listen appreciatively to the music of the spheres, but they don't feel the urge to get down and boogie to it. So, none. At least, nearly none. Azrael had learned to gavotte in a discreet gentleman's club in Portland Place in the late 1880s, and while he had initially taken to it like a duck to merchant banking, after a while he had become quite good at it, and was quite put out when, some decades later, the gavotte went out of style for good. So, providing the dance was a gavotte, and providing that he had a suitable partner, also able, for the sake of argument, both to gavotte and to dance it on the head of a pin, the answer is a straightforward one. Then again, you might just as well ask how many demons can dance on the head of a pin. They're of the same original stock, after all. And at least they dance. Note, although it's not what you and I would call dancing, not good dancing anyway, a demon moves like a white band on Soul Train. End note. And if you put it that way, the answer is quite a lot, actually, providing they abandon their physical bodies, which is a picnic for a demon. Demons aren't bound by physics. If you take the long view, the universe is just something small and round. like those water-filled balls which produce a miniature snowstorm when you shake them. Note. Although, unless the ineffable plan is a lot more ineffable than it's given credit for, it does not have a giant plastic snowman at the bottom. End note. But if you look from really close up, the only problem about dancing on the head of a pin is all those big gaps between electrons. For those of angel stock or demon breed, size and shape and composition are simply options. Crowley is currently traveling incredibly fast down a telephone line. Ring! Crowley went through two telephone exchanges at a very respectable fraction of light speed. Haster was a little way behind him, 4 or 5 inches, but at that size, it gave Crowley a very comfortable lead, one that would vanish, of course, when he came out the other end. They were too small for sound, but demons don't necessarily need sound to communicate. He could hear Haster screaming behind him, "You bastard! I'll get you! You can't escape me! Ring! Wherever you come out, I'll come out too. You won't get away." Crowley had traveled through over 20 miles of cable in less than a second. Haster was close behind him. Crowley was going to have to time this whole thing very, very carefully. Ring! That was the third ring. Well, thought Crowley, here goes nothing. He stopped suddenly and watched Haster shoot past him. Haster turned and, ring! Crowley shot out through the phone line, zapped through the plastic sheathing, and materialized, full size and out of breath, in his lounge. Click! The outgoing message tape began to turn on his answerphone. Then there was a beep, and as the incoming message tape turned, a voice from the speaker screamed after the beep. Right. What? You bloody snake. The little red message light began to flash, on and off, and on and off, like a tiny red angry eye. Crowley really wished he had some more holy water, and the time to hold the cassette in it until it dissolved. But getting hold of Liger's terminal bath had been dangerous enough. He'd had it for years, just in case, and even its presence in the room made him uneasy. Or maybe. Yes, what would happen if he put the cassette in the car? He could play Haster over and over again until he turned into Freddie Mercury. No, he might be a bastard, but you could only go so far. There was a rumble of distant thunder. He had no time to spare. He had nowhere to go. He went anyway. He ran down to his Bentley and drove toward the West End as if all the demons of hell were after him, which was more or less the case. Madam Tracy heard Mr. Shadwell's slow tread come up the stairs. It was slower than usual and paused every few steps. Normally, he came up the stairs as if he hated every one of them. She opened her door. He was leaning against the landing wall. "Why, Mr. Shadwell," she said, "whatever have you done to your hand?"
"Get away from me, woman," Shadwell groaned. "I dinna know my ain powers."
"Why are you holding it out like that?" Shadwell tried to back into the wall.
"Stand back, I tell ye. I canna be responsible."
"What on earth has happened to you, Mr. Shadwell?" said Madam Tracy, trying to take his hand.
"Nothing on earth. Nothing on earth."
She managed to grab his arm. He, Shadwell, scourge of evil, was powerless to resist being drawn into her flat. He'd never been in it before, at least in his waking moments. His dreams had furnished it in silks, rich hangings, and what he thought of as scented unguents. Admittedly, it did have a bead curtain in the entrance to the kitchenette, and a lamp made rather inexpertly from a Chianti bottle, because Madame Tracy's apprehension of what was chic, like Aziraphale's, had grounded around 1953. And there was a table in the middle of the room with a velvet cloth on it, and on the cloth, the crystal ball, which increasingly was Madame Tracy's means of earning a living. "I think you could do with a good lie-down, Mr. Shadwell," she said, in a voice that brooked no argument, and led him on into the bedroom. He was too bewildered to protest.
"But young Newt is out there," Shadwell muttered, "in thrall to heathen passions and occult wiles."
"Then I'm sure he'll know what to do about them," said Madame Tracy briskly, whose mental picture of what Newt was going through was probably much closer to reality than was Shadwell's. "And I'm sure he wouldn't like to think of you getting yourself worked up into a state here. Just you lie down, and I'll make us both a nice cup of tea." She disappeared in a clacking of bead curtains. Suddenly, Shadwell was alone on what he was just capable of recalling through the wreckage of his shattered nerves, was a bed of sin, and right at this moment was incapable of deciding whether that was in fact better or worse than not being alone on a bed of sin. He turned his head to take in his surroundings. Madame Tracy's concepts of what was erotic stemmed from the days when young men grew up thinking that women had beach balls affixed firmly in front of their anatomy. Brigitte Bardot could be called a sex kitten without anyone bursting out laughing, and there really were magazines with names like Girls, Giggles, and Garters. Somewhere in this cauldron of permissiveness, she had picked up the idea that soft toys in the bedroom created an intimate, coquettish air. Shadwell stared for some time at a large, threadbare teddy bear, which had one eye missing and a torn ear. It probably had a name like Mr. Buggins. He turned his head the other way. His gaze was blocked by a pajama case, shaped like an animal that may have been a dog, but, there again, might have been a skunk. It had a cheery grin.
"Urg," he said.
But recollection kept storming back. He really had done it. No one else in the army had ever exorcised a demon, as far as he knew. Not Hopkins, not Siftings, not Diceman. Probably not even Witchfinder Company Sergeant Major Narker. Note: the WA enjoyed a renaissance during the great days of empire expansionism. The British Army's endless skirmishes frequently brought it up against witch doctors, bone pointers, shamans, and other occult adversaries. This was the cue for the deployment of the likes of W.A. C.S.M. Narker, whose striding, bellowing, 6'6", 18-stone figure, clutching an armor-plated book, 8-pound bell, and specially reinforced candle, could clear the veldt of adversaries faster than a Gatling gun. Cecil Rhodes wrote of him, "Some remote tribes consider him to be a kind of god, and it is an extremely brave or foolhardy witch doctor who will stand his ground with C.S.M. Narker bearing down on him. I would rather have this man on my side than two battalions of Gurkhas." End note. Who held the all-time record for most witches found? Sooner or later, every army runs across its ultimate weapon. And now it existed, Shadwell reflected, on the end of his arm. Well, screw no first use. He'd have a bit of a rest, seeing as he was here, and then the powers of darkness had met their match at last. When Madame Tracy brought the tea in, he was snoring. She tactfully closed the door, and rather thankfully as well, because she had a seance due in 20 minutes, and it was no good turning down money these days. Although Madame Tracy was by many yardsticks quite stupid, she had an instinct in certain matters, and when it came to dabbling in the occult, her reasoning was faultless. Dabbling, she'd realized, was exactly what her customers wanted. They didn't want to be shoved in it up to their necks. They didn't want the multi-planular mysteries of time and space. They just wanted to be reassured that Mother was getting along fine now she was dead. They wanted just enough occult to season the simple fare of their lives, and preferably in portions no longer than 45 minutes, followed by tea and biscuits. They certainly didn't want odd candles, scents, chants, or mystic runes. Madame Tracy had even removed most of the major arcana from her tarot card pack, because their appearance tended to upset people. And she made sure that she had always put sprouts on to boil just before a seance. Nothing is more reassuring, nothing is more true to the comfortable spirit of English occultism than the smell of Brussels sprouts cooking in the next room. It was early afternoon, and the heavy storm clouds had turned the sky the color of old lead. It would rain soon, heavily, blindingly. The firemen hoped the rain would come soon, the sooner the better. They had arrived fairly promptly, and the younger firemen were dashing around excitedly, unrolling their hose pipe and flexing their axes. The older firemen knew at a glance that the building was a dead loss, and weren't even sure that the rain would stop it spreading to neighboring buildings, when a black Bentley skidded around the corner and drove up onto the pavement at a speed somewhere in excess of 60 miles per hour, and stopped with a screech of brakes half an inch away from the wall of the bookshop. An extremely agitated young man in dark glasses got out and ran toward the door of the blazing bookshop. He was intercepted by a fireman. "Are you the owner of this establishment?" asked the fireman. "Don't be stupid. Do I look like I run a bookshop?" "I really wouldn't know about that, sir. Appearances can be very deceptive. For example, I am a fireman. However, upon meeting me socially, people unaware of my occupation often suppose that I am, in fact, a chartered accountant or company director. Imagine me out of uniform, sir, and what kind of man would you see before you? Honestly?" "A prat," said Crowley, and he ran into the bookshop. This sounds easier than it actually was, since in order to manage it, Crowley needed to avoid half a dozen firemen, two policemen, and a number of interesting Soho night people. Note: in any other place than Soho, it is quite possible that spectators at a fire might have been interested. End note. Out early and arguing heatedly amongst themselves about which particular section of society had brightened up the afternoon and why. Crowley pushed straight through them. They scarcely spared him a glance. Then he pushed open the door and stepped into an inferno. The whole bookshop was ablaze. "Azrafael," he called. "Azrafael, you stupid... Azrafael, are you here?" No answer. Just the crackle of burning paper, the splintering of glass as the fire reached the upstairs rooms, the crash of collapsing timbers. He scanned the shop urgently, desperately, looking for the angel, looking for help. In the far corner, a bookshelf toppled over, cascading flaming books across the floor. The fire was all around him, and Crowley ignored it. His left trouser leg began to smolder. He stopped it with a glance. "Hello? Azrafael? For somebody's sake, Azrafael!" The shop window was smashed from outside. Crowley turned, startled, and an unexpected jet of water struck him full in the chest, knocking him to the ground. His shades flew to a far corner of the room and became a puddle of burning plastic. Yellow eyes with slitted vertical pupils were revealed. Wet and steaming, face ash blackened, as far from cool as it was possible for him to be, on all fours in the blazing bookshop, Crowley cursed Azrafael and the ineffable plan, and above and below. Then he looked down and saw it. the book. The book that the girl had left in the car in Tadfield on Wednesday night. It was slightly scorched around the cover, but miraculously unharmed. He picked it up, stuffed it into his jacket pocket, stood up unsteadily, and brushed himself off. The floor above him collapsed. With a roar and gargantuan shrug, the building fell in on itself, in a rain of brick and timber and flaming debris. Outside, the passers-by were being herded back by the police, and the fireman was explaining to anyone who would listen, "I couldn't stop him. He must have been mad, or drunk. Just ran in. I couldn't stop him. Mad, ran straight in. Horrible way to die. Horrible, horrible. Just ran straight in." Then Crowley came out of the flames. The police and the firemen looked at him, saw the expression on his face, and stayed exactly where they were. He climbed into the Bentley and reversed back into the road, swung around a fire truck into Wardour Street and into the darkened afternoon. They stared at the car as it sped away. Finally, one policeman spoke. "Weather like this, he ought to have put his lights on," he said numbly. "Especially driving like that. Could be dangerous," agreed another, in flat, dead tones. And they all stood there in the light and the heat of the burning bookshop, wondering what was happening to a world they had thought they understood. There was a flash of lightning, blue-white, strobing across the cloud-black sky, a crack of thunder so loud it hurt, and a hard rain began to fall. She rode a red motorbike, not a friendly Honda red, a deep, bloody red, rich and dark and hateful. The bike was apparently, in every other respect, ordinary, except for the sword resting in its scabbard, set onto the side of the bike. Her helmet was crimson, and her leather jacket was the color of old wine. In ruby studs on the back were picked out the words, "Hell's Angels." It was 1:10 in the afternoon, and it was dark and humid and wet. The motorway was almost deserted, and the woman in red roared down the road on her red motorbike, smiling lazily. It had been a good day so far. There was something about the sight of a beautiful woman on a powerful motorbike with a sword stuck on the back that had a powerful effect on a certain type of man. So far, four traveling salesmen had tried to race her, and bits of Ford Sierra now decorated the crash barriers and bridge supports along 40 miles of motorway. She pulled up at a service area and went into the Happy Porker Cafe. It was almost empty. A bored waitress was darning a sock behind the counter, and a knot of black-leathered bikers, hard, hairy, filthy, and huge, were clustered around an even taller individual in a black coat. He was resolutely playing something that, in bygone years, would have been a fruit machine, but now had a video screen, and advertised itself as Trivia Scrabble. The audience were saying things like, "It's D, press D. The Godfather must have got more Oscars than Gone with the Wind. Puppet on a String, Sandy Shaw, honest, I'm bleeding positive. 1666. No, you great pillock, that was the fire. The plague was 1665. It's B. The Great Wall of China wasn't one of the seven wonders of the world." There were four options: pop music, sport, current events, and general knowledge. The tall biker, who had kept his helmet on, was pressing the buttons, to all intents and purposes, oblivious of his supporters. At any rate, he was consistently winning. The Red Rider went over to the counter. "A cup of tea, please, and a cheese sandwich," she said. "You on your own, then, dear?" asked the waitress, passing the tea and something white and dry and hard across the counter. "Waiting for friends."
Ah, she said, fighting through some wool. Well, you're better off waiting in here. It's hell out there.
No, she told her. Not yet. She picked a window table with a good view of the parking lot, and she waited. She could hear the trivia scrabblers in the background.
That's a new one. How many times has England been officially at war with France since 1066? 20? Nah, it's never 20. Oh, it was. Well, I never. American war with Mexico? I know that. It's June, 1845. D. See, I told you.
The second shortest biker, Pigbog, 6'3", whispered to the shortest, Greaser, 6'2".
What happened to sport, then?
He had love tattooed on one set of knuckles, hate on the other.
It's random wasset selection, isn't it? I mean, they do it with microchips. It's probably got, like, millions of different subjects in there, in its RAM.
He had fish across his right-hand knuckle and chip on the left.
Pop music, current events, general knowledge, and war. It's just I've never seen war before. That's why I mentioned it.
Pigbog cracked his knuckles loudly and pulled the ring tab on a can of beer. He swigged back half a can, belched carelessly, then sighed.
I just wish they'd do more bleeding Bible questions.
Why? Greaser had never thought of Pigbog as being a Bible trivia freak.
Cause, well, you remember that bit of bother in Brighton? Oh, yeah, you was on crime watch,
said Greaser, with a trace of envy.
Well, I had to hang out in that hotel where me ma'am worked. Dinner? 3 months, and nothing to read, only this bugger Gideon had left his Bible behind. It kind of sticks in your mind.
Another motorbike, jet black and gleaming, drew up in the car park outside. The door to the cafe opened. A blast of cold wind blew through the room. A man dressed all in black leather, with a short black beard, walked over to the table, sat next to the woman in red, and the bikers around the video scrabble machine suddenly noticed how hungry they all were, and deputed Scuzz to go and get them something to eat. All of them, except the player, who said nothing, just pressed the buttons for the right answers and let his winnings accumulate in the tray at the bottom of the machine.
I haven't seen you since Mafeking, said Red. How's it been going?
I've been keeping pretty busy, said Black. Spent a lot of time in America. Brief world tours, just killing time, really.
What do you mean you've got no steak and kidney pies?
Asked Scuzz, affronted.
I thought we had some, but we don't, said the woman.
Feels funny. All of us finally getting together like this, said Red.
Funny?
Well, you know, when you've spent all these thousands of years waiting for the big day, and it finally comes, like waiting for Christmas, or birthdays.
We don't have birthdays.
I didn't say we do. I just said that was what it was like.
Actually, admitted the woman, it doesn't look like we've got anything left at all, except that slice of pizza. Has it got anchovies on it?
Asked Scuzz gloomily. None of the chapter liked anchovies. Or olives.
Yes, dear. It's anchovy and olives. Would you like it?
Scuzz shook his head sadly, stomach rumbling. He made his way back to the game. Big Ted got irritable when he got hungry, and when Big Ted got irritable, everyone got a slice. A new category had come up on the video screen. You could now answer questions about pop music, current events, famine, or war. the bikers seem marginally less informed about the Irish potato famine of 1846, the English everything famine of 1315, and the 1969 dope famine in San Francisco than they had been about war. But the player was still racking up a perfect score, punctuated occasionally by a whir, ratchet, and chink as the machine disgorged pound coins into its tray. "Weather looks a bit tricky down south," said Red. Black squinted at the darkening clouds. "No, looks fine to me. We'll have a thunderstorm along any minute." Red looked at her nails. "That's good. It wouldn't be the same if we didn't have a good thunderstorm. Any idea how far we've got to ride?" Black shrugged. "A few hundred miles." "I thought it'd be longer somehow. All that waiting, just for a few hundred miles."
"It's not the traveling," said Black. "It's the arriving that matters."
There was a roar outside. It was the roar of a motorbike with a defective exhaust, untuned engine, leaky carburetor. You didn't have to see the bike to imagine the clouds of black smoke it traveled in, the oil slicks it left in its wake, the trail of small motorbike parts and fittings that littered the roads behind it. Black went up to the counter. "Four teas, please," he said. "One black." The cafe door opened. A young man in dusty white leathers entered, and the wind blew empty crisp packets and newspapers and ice cream wrappers in with him. They danced around his feet like excited children, then fell exhausted to the floor.
"Four of you, are there, dear?"
asked the woman. She was trying to find some clean cups and teaspoons. The entire rack seemed suddenly to have been coated in a light film of motor oil and dried egg.
"There will be," said the man in black, and he took the teas and went back to the table, where his two comrades waited.
"Any sign of him?" said the boy in white. They shook their heads. An argument had broken out around the video screen. Current categories showing on the screen were war, famine, pollution, and pop trivia, 1962 to 1979.
"Elvis Presley? Scotta B.C. It was 1977 he snuffed it, wasn't it? Nah, D, 1976, I'm positive. Yeah, same year as Bing Crosby. And Mark Bowen, he was dead good. Press D then, go on."
The tall figure made no motion to press any of the buttons.
"What's the matter with you?" asked Big Ted irritably. "Go on. Press D. Elvis Presley died in 1976.
"I don't care what it says," said the tall biker in the helmet. "I never laid a finger on him."
The three people at the table turned as one. Red spoke.
"When did you get here?" she asked.
The tall man walked over to the table, leaving the astonished bikers and his winnings behind him.
"I never went away," he said, and his voice was a dark echo from the night places, a cold slab of sound, gray and dead. If that voice was a stone, it would have had words chiseled on it a long time ago, a name and two dates.
"Your tea's getting cold, Lord," said Famine.
"It's been a long time," said War. There was a flash of lightning, almost immediately followed by a low rumble of thunder.
"Lovely weather for it," said Pollution.
"Yes."
The bikers around the game were getting progressively baffled by this exchange. Led by Big Ted, they shambled over to the table and stared at the four strangers. It did not escape their notice that all four strangers had Hell's Angels on their jackets. and they looked dead dodgy as far as the angels were concerned. Too clean for a start, and none of the four looked like they'd ever broken anyone's arm just because it was Sunday afternoon and there wasn't anything good on the telly. And one was a woman, too, only not riding around on the back of someone's bike, but actually allowed one of her own, like she had any right to it. "You're Hell's Angels, then?" asked Big Ted sarcastically. If there's one thing real Hell's Angels can't abide, it's weekend bikers. Note: there are a number of other things real Hell's Angels can't abide. These include the police, soap, Ford Cortinas, and in Big Ted's case, anchovies and olives. End note. The four strangers nodded. "What chapter are you from, then?" The tall stranger looked at Big Ted. Then he stood up. It was a complicated motion. If the shores of the Seas of Night had deck chairs, they'd open up something like that. He seemed to be unfolding himself forever. He wore a dark helmet, completely hiding his features. And it was made of that weird plastic, Big Ted noted. Like you looked in it, and all you could see was your own face. "Revelations," he said. "Chapter 6. Verses 2 to 8, added the boy in white, helpfully. Big Ted glared at the four of them. His lower jaw began to protrude, and a little blue vein in his temple started to throb. "What does that mean, then?" he demanded. There was a tug at his sleeve. It was Pig Bog. He had gone a peculiar shade of gray under the dirt.
"It means we're in trouble," said Pig Bog.
And then the tall stranger reached up a pale motorbike gauntlet and raised the visor of his helmet. And Big Ted found himself wishing, for the first time in his existence, that he'd lived a better life.
"Jesus Christ," he moaned. "I think he may be along in a minute," said Pig Bog urgently. "He's probably looking for somewhere to park his bike. Let's go and join a youth club or something."
But Big Ted's invincible ignorance was his shield and armor. He didn't move.
"Cor," he said. "Hell's Angels."
War flipped him a lazy salute. "That's us, Big Ted," she said. "The real McCoy." Famine nodded. "The old firm," he said. Pollution removed his helmet and shook out his long white hair. He had taken over when Pestilence, muttering about penicillin, had retired in 1936. If only the old boy had known what opportunities the future had held. "Others promise," he said. "We deliver." Big Ted looked at the fourth horseman.
"Here, I seen you before," he said. "You was on the cover of that Blue Oyster Cult album, and I got a ring with your head on it."
"I get everywhere."
"Cor."
Big Ted's big face screwed up with the effort of thought.
"What kind of bike you riding?"
he said. The storm raged around the quarry. The rope with the old car tire on it danced in the gale. Sometimes a sheet of iron, relic of an attempt at a treehouse, would shake loose from its insubstantial moorings and sail away. The them huddled together, staring at Adam. He seemed bigger, somehow. Dog sat and growled. He was thinking of all the smells he would lose. There were no smells in hell, apart from the sulfur. While some of them here were... Well, the fact was, there were no bitches in hell, either. Adam was marching about excitedly, waving his hands in the air.
"There'll be no end to the fun we can have," he said. "There'll be exploring and everything. I expect I can soon get the old jungles to grow again." But who'll do the, you know, all the cooking and washing and such like?" quavered Brian. "No one'll have to do any of that stuff," said Adam. "You can have all the food you like, loads of chips, fried onion rings, anything you like, and never have to wear any new clothes or have a bath if you don't want to or anything, or go to school or anything, or do anything you don't want to do ever again. It'll be wicked."
The moon came up over the Cucamonga Hills. It was very bright tonight. Johnny Two Bones sat in the red basin of the desert. It was a sacred place, where two ancestral rocks, formed in the dreamtime, lay as they had since the beginning. Johnny Two Bones' walkabout was coming to an end. His cheeks and chest were smeared with red ochre, and he was singing an old song, a sort of singing map of the hills, and he was drawing patterns in the dust with his spear. He had not eaten for 2 days. He had not slept. He was approaching a trance state, making him one with the bush, putting him into communion with his ancestors. He was nearly there. Nearly. He blinked, looked around wonderingly.
"Excuse me, dear boy,"
he said to himself, out loud, in precise, enunciated tones.
"But have you any idea where I am?"
"Who said that?"
said Johnny Two Bones. His mouth opened.
"I did."
Johnny scratched thoughtfully.
"I take it you're one of me ancestors, then, mate?"
"Oh, indubitably, dear boy. Quite indubitably, in a manner of speaking. Now, to get back to my original question, where am I?"
"Only if you're one of my ancestors," continued Johnny Two Bones. "Why are you talking like a poofter?"
"Oh, Australia,"
said Johnny Two Bones' mouth, pronouncing the word as though it would have to be properly disinfected before he said it again.
"Oh, dear. Well, thank you anyway."
"Hello? Hello?"
said Johnny Two Bones. He sat in the sand, and he waited, and he waited, but he didn't reply. Azrafael had moved on. Citron Do Chavol was Tonton Macoute, a traveling hoongan. Note, magician or priest. Voodoon is a very interesting religion for the whole family, even those members of it who are dead. End note. He had a satchel over his shoulder, containing magical plants, medicinal plants, bits of wildcat, black candles, a powder derived chiefly from the skin of a certain dried fish, a dead centipede, a half bottle of Chivas Regal, 10 Rothmans, and a copy of What's On in Haiti. He hefted the knife, and with an experienced slicing motion, cut the head from a black cockerel. Blood washed over his right hand.
"Loa ride me," he intoned. "Gros bonange, come to me."
"Where am I?"
he said.
"Is that my gros bonange?"
he asked himself.
"I think that's a rather personal question," he replied. "I mean, as these things go. But one tries, as it were. One does one's best."
Citron found one of his hands reaching for the cockerel.
"Rather unsanitary place to do your cooking, don't you think? Out here in the jungle. Having a barbecue, are we? What kind of place is this?"
"Haitian," he answered.
"Damn, nowhere near. Still, could be worse. Well, I must be on my way. Be good."
And Citron Do Chavol was alone in his head.
Loas be buggered,
he muttered to himself. He stared into nothing for a while, and then reached for the satchel and its bottle of Chivas Regal. There are at least two ways to turn someone into a zombie. He was going to take the easiest. The surf was loud on the beaches. The palms shook. A storm was coming. The lights went up. The power cable, Nebraska, evangelical choir, launched into Jesus is the telephone repairman on the switchboard of my life, and almost drowned out the sound of the rising wind. Marvin O. Bagman adjusted his tie, checked his grin in the mirror, patted the bottom of his personal assistant, Miss Cindy Kellerhals, penthouse pet of the month 3 years ago last July, but she had put that all behind her when she got career. And he walked out onto the studio floor. Jesus won't cut you off before you're through. With him, you won't never get a crossed line. And when your bill comes, it'll all be properly itemized. He's the telephone repairman on the switchboard of my life, the choir sang. Marvin was fond of that song. He had written it himself. Other songs he had written included Happy Mr. Jesus, Jesus, Can I Come and Stay at Your Place, That Old Fiery Cross, Jesus is the Sticker on the Bumper of My Soul, and When I'm Swept Up by the Rapture, Grab the Wheel of My Pickup. They were available on Jesus is My Buddy, LP, cassette, and CD, and were advertised every 4 minutes on Bagman's Evangelical Network. Note, $12.95 per LP or cassette, $24.95 per CD, although you got a free copy of the LP with every $500 you donated to Marvin Bagman's mission. End note. Despite the fact that the lyrics didn't rhyme, or as a rule make any sense, and that Marvin, who was not particularly musical, had stolen all the tunes from old country songs, Jesus is My Buddy had sold over 4 million copies. Marvin had started off as a country singer, singing old Conway Twitty and Johnny Cash songs. He had done regular live concerts from San Quentin Jail, until the civil rights people got him under the Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause. It was then that Marvin got religion. Not the quiet, personal kind that involves doing good deeds and living a better life. Not even the kind that involves putting on a suit and ringing people's doorbells. But the kind that involves having your own TV network and getting people to send you money. He had found the perfect TV mix on Marvin's Hour of Power, the show that put the fun back into Fundamentalist. 4 3-minute songs from the LP, 20 minutes of Hellfire, and 5 minutes of Healing People. The remaining 23 minutes were spent alternately cajoling, pleading, threatening, begging, and occasionally simply asking for money. In the early days, he had actually brought people into the studio to heal, but had found that too complicated. So these days, he simply proclaimed visions vouchsafed to him of viewers all across America getting magically cured as they watched. This was much simpler. He no longer needed to hire actors, and there was no way anyone could check on his success rate. Note, it might have surprised Marvin to know there actually was a success rate. Some people would get better from anything. End note. The world is a lot more complicated than most people believe. Many people believed, for example, that Marvin was not a true believer because he made so much money out of it. They were wrong. He believed with all his heart. He believed utterly and spent a lot of the money that flooded in on what he really thought was the Lord's work. The phone line to the Savior is always free of interference. He's in at any hour, day or night. And when you call Jesus, you always call toll-free. He's the telephone repairman on the switchboard of my life. The first song concluded, and Marvin walked in front of the cameras and raised his arms modestly for silence. In the control booth, the engineer turned down the applause track.
Brothers and sisters, thank you. Thank you. Wasn't that beautiful? And remember, you can hear that song and others just as edifying on Jesus Is My Buddy. Just phone 1-800-CASH and pledge your donation now.
He became more serious.
Brothers and sisters, I've got a message for you all, an urgent message from our Lord. For you all, man and woman, and little babes, friends, let me tell you about the apocalypse. It's all there in your Bible, in the revelation our Lord gave St. John on Patmos, and in the book of Daniel. The Lord always gives it to you straight, friends, your future. So what's going to happen? War, plague, famine, death, rivers of blood, great earthquakes, nuclear missiles. Horrible times are coming, brothers and sisters, and there's only one way to avoid them. Before the destruction comes, before the four horsemen of the apocalypse ride out, before the nuclear missiles rain down on the unbelievers, there will come the rapture. What's the rapture? I hear you cry. When the rapture comes, brothers and sisters, all the true believers will be swept up in the air. You don't mind what you're doing. You could be in the bath. You could be at work. You could be driving your car. Or just sitting at home reading your Bible. Suddenly, you'll be up there in the air, in perfect and incorruptible bodies, and you'll be up in the air, looking down at the world as the years of destruction arrive. Only the faithful will be saved. Only those of you who have been born again will avoid the pain and the death and the horror and the burning. Then will come the great war between heaven and hell, and heaven will destroy the forces of hell, and God shall wipe away the tears of the suffering, and there shall be no more death, or sorrow, or crying, or pain, and he shall reign in glory forever and ever.
He stopped. Suddenly. Well, nice try, he said in a completely different voice. Only, it won't be like that at all. Not really. I mean, you're right about the fire and war, all that. But that rapture stuff, well, if you could see them all in heaven, serried ranks of them as far as the mind can follow and beyond, league after league of us, flaming swords, all that, well, what I'm trying to say is, who has time to go round picking people out and popping them up in the air to sneer at the people dying of radiation sickness on the parched and burning earth below them? If that's your idea of a morally acceptable time, I might add. And as for that stuff about heaven inevitably winning, well, to be honest, if it were that cut and dried, there wouldn't be a celestial war in the first place, would there? It's propaganda, pure and simple. We've got no more than a 50% chance of coming out on top. You might just as well send money to a Satanist hotline to cover your bets. Although, to be frank, when the fire falls and the seas of blood rise, you lot are all going to be civilian casualties either way. Between our war and your war, they're going to kill everyone and let God sort it out. Right? Anyway, sorry to stand here wittering. I've just a quick question. Where am I? Marvin O. Bagman was gradually going purple.
It's the devil. Lord, protect me. The devil is speaking through me.
He erupted and interrupted himself.
Oh, no. Quite the opposite, in fact. I'm an angel.
Ah, this has to be America, doesn't it?
So sorry. Can't stay.
There was a pause. Marvin tried to open his mouth, but nothing happened. Whatever was in his head looked around. He looked at the studio crew, those who weren't phoning the police or sobbing in corners. He looked at the gray-faced cameraman.
"Gosh," he said, "am I on television?"
Crowley was doing 120 miles an hour down Oxford Street. He reached into the glove compartment for his spare pair of sunglasses and found only cassettes. Irritably, he grabbed one at random and pushed it into the slot. He wanted Bach, but he would settle for the traveling Wilburys. "All we need is Radio Gaga," sang Freddie Mercury. "All I need is out," thought Crowley. He swung around the Marble Arch roundabout the wrong way, doing 90. Lightning made the London skies flicker like a malfunctioning fluorescent tube. "A livid sky on London," Crowley thought, "and I knew the end was near." Who had written that? Chesterton, wasn't it? The only poet in the 20th century to even come close to the truth. The Bentley headed out of London while Crowley sat back in the driver's seat and thumbed through the singed copy of the Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter. Near the end of the book, he found a folded sheet of paper covered in Aziraphale's neat copperplate handwriting. He unfolded it, while the Bentley's gear stick shifted itself down to third and the car accelerated around a fruit lorry which had unexpectedly backed out of a side street. And then he read it again. Then he read it one more time, with a slow sinking feeling at the base of his stomach. The car changed direction suddenly. It was now heading for the village of Tadfield, in Oxfordshire. He could be there in an hour if he hurried. Anyway, there wasn't really anywhere else to go. The cassette finished, activating the car radio.
"Gardener's Question Time, coming to you from Tadfield Gardening Club. We were lost here in 1953, a very nice summer, and as the team will remember, it's a rich Oxfordshire loam in the east of the parish, rising to chalk in the west. The kind of place, I say, don't matter what you plant here, it'll come up beautiful. Isn't that right, Fred?"
"Yup," said Professor Fred Windbright, Royal Botanical Gardens.
"Couldn't have put it better myself." "Right. First question for the team, and this comes from Mr. R.P. Tyler, chairman of the local residents' association, I do believe."
"That's right. Well, I'm a keen rose grower, but my prize-winning Molly Maguire lost a couple of blossoms yesterday in a rain of what were apparently fish. What does the team recommend for this, other than place netting over the garden? I mean, I've written to the council."
"Not a common problem, I'd say. Harry?"
"Mr. Tyler, let me ask you a question. Were these fresh fish or preserved?"
"Fresh, I believe."
"Well, you've got no problems, my friend. I hear you've also been having rains of blood in these parts, and I wish we had these up in the Dales, where my garden is. Save me a fortune in fertilizers. Now, what you do is, you dig them into your..."
"Crowley?"
Crowley said nothing.
"Crowley, the war has begun, Crowley. We note with interest that you avoided the forces we empowered to collect you."
Crowley agreed.
"Crowley, we will win this war, but even if we lose, at least as far as you are concerned, it will make no difference at all. For as long as there is one demon left in hell, Crowley, you will wish you had been created mortal."
Crowley was silent.
"Mortals can hope for death, or for redemption. You can hope for nothing. All you can hope for is the mercy of hell."
"Yeah?"
"Just our little joke.
ink, said Crowley.
Now, as keen gardeners know, it goes without saying that he's a cunning little devil, your Tibetan, tunneling straight through your begonias like it was nobody's business. A cup of tea'll shift him, with rancid yak butter for preference. You should be able to get some at any good garden.
Bee, whiz, pop. Static drowned out the rest of the program. Crowley turned off the radio and bit his lower lip. Beneath the ash and soot that flaked his face, he looked very tired, and very pale, and very scared. And suddenly, very angry. It was the way they talked to you, as if you were a houseplant who had started shedding leaves on the carpet. And then he turned the corner, which was meant to take him onto the slip road to the M-25, from which he'd swing off onto the M-40 up to Oxfordshire. But something had happened to the M-25, something that hurt your eyes if you looked directly at it. From what had been the M-25 London orbital motorway came a low chanting, a noise formed of many strands, car horns and engines and sirens, and the bleep of cellular telephones, and the screaming of small children trapped by backseat seatbelts forever. "Hail the great beast, devourer of worlds," came the chanting, over and over again, in the secret tongue of the black priesthood of ancient Mu. The dreaded Sigil Odegra, thought Crowley, as he swung the car around, heading for the North Circular. I did that. That's my fault. It could have been just another motorway. A good job, I'll grant you. But was it really worthwhile? It's all out of control. Heaven and hell aren't running things anymore. It's like the whole planet is a third-world country that's finally got the bomb. Then he began to smile. He snapped his fingers. A pair of dark glasses materialized out of his eyes. The ash vanished from his suit and his skin. What the hell? If you had to go, why not go with style? Whistling softly, he drove. They came down the outside lane of the motorway like destroying angels, which was fair enough. They weren't going that fast, all things considered. The four of them were holding a steady 105 miles per hour, as if they were confident that the show could not start before they got there. It couldn't. They had all the time in the world, such as it was. Just behind them came four other riders, Big Ted, Greaser, Pig Bog, and Scuzz. They were elated. They were real Hell's Angels now, and they rode the silence. Around them, they knew, was the roar of the thunderstorm, the thunder of traffic, the whipping of the wind and the rain. But in the wake of the horsemen, there was silence, pure and dead. Almost pure, anyway. Certainly dead. It was broken by Pig Bog, shouting to Big Ted.
"What you going to be, then?" he asked hoarsely.
"What?"
"I said, what you..."
"I heard what you said. It's not what you said. Everyone heard what you said. What did you mean? That's what I want to know."
Pig Bog wished he'd paid more attention to the Book of Revelation. If he'd known he was going to be in it, he'd have read it more carefully.
"What I mean is, they're the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right?"
"Bikers," said Greaser.
"Right. Four bikers of the apocalypse. War, famine, death, and the other one, pollution."
"Yeah? So?"
"So, they said it was all right if we came with them, right?"
"So?"
"So, we're the other four horse, bikers of the apocalypse. So which ones are we?"
There was a pause. The lights of passing cars shot past them in the opposite lane. Lightning afterimaged the clouds, and the silence was close to absolute.
Can I be war as well?
Asked Big Ted. Course you can't be war. How can you be war? She's war. You've got to be something else.
Big Ted screwed up his face with the effort of thought.
GBH, he said eventually. I'm Grievous Bodily Harm. That's me. There. What are you going to be?
Can I be rubbish?
Asks Scuzz.
Or embarrassing personal problems?
Can't be rubbish, said Grievous Bodily Harm. He's got that one sewn up, pollution. You can be the other, though.
They rode on in the silence and the dark, the rear red lights of the four a few hundred yards in front of them.
Grievous Bodily Harm, Embarrassing Personal Problems, Pig Bog, and Greaser.
I wanna be cruelty to animals, said Greaser.
Pig Bog wondered if he was for or against it. Not that it really mattered. And then it was Pig Bog's turn.
I think I'll be them answer phones. They're pretty bad, he said. You can't be answer phones. What kind of a biker of the Repocalypse is answer phones? That's stupid, that is.
Snot, said Pig Bog, nettled. It's like war and famine and that. It's a problem of life, isn't it?
Answer phones. I hate bloody answer phones.
I hate answer phones, too, said Cruelty to Animals.
You can shut up, said GBH.
Can I change mine?
Asked Embarrassing Personal Problems, who had been thinking intently since he last spoke.
I want to be things not working properly even after you've thumped them.
All right, you can change, but you can't be answer phones, Pig Bog. Pick something else.
Pig Bog pondered. He wished he'd never broached the subject. It was like the careers interviews he had had as a schoolboy. He deliberated.
Really cool people, he said at last. I hate them.
Really cool people?
Said things not working properly even after you've given them a good thumping.
Yeah, you know, the kind you see on telly, with stupid haircuts. Only on them, it don't look stupid, 'cause it's them. They wear baggy suits, and you're not allowed to say they're a bunch of wankers. I mean, speaking for me, what I always want to do when I see one of them is push their faces very slowly through a barbed wire fence. And what I think is this.
He took a deep breath. He was sure this was the longest speech he had ever made in his life. Note. Except for one about 10 years earlier, throwing himself on the mercy of the court. End note.
What I think is this. If they get up my nose like that, they'll probably get up everyone else's.
Yeah, said Cruelty to Animals. And they all wear sunglasses even when they don't need 'em.
Eating runny cheese and that stupid bloody no-alcohol lager,
said things not working properly even after you've given them a good thumping.
I hate that stuff. What's the point of drinking this stuff if it don't leave you puking? Here, I just thought. Can I change again so I'm no-alcohol lager?
No, you bloody can't, said Grievous Bodily Harm. You've changed once already.
Anyway, said Pig Bog, that's why I want to be really cool people.
All right, said his leader.
Don't see why I can't be no bloody alcohol lager if I want. Shut your face.
Death and famine and war and pollution continued biking toward Tadfield. And Grievous Bodily Harm, Cruelty to Animals, things not working properly even after you've given them a good thumping, but secretly no alcohol lager, and really cool people traveled with them. It was a wet and blustery Saturday afternoon, and Madame Tracy was feeling very occult. She had her flowing dress on, and a saucepan full of sprouts on the stove. The room was lit by candlelight, each candle carefully placed in a wax-encrusted wine bottle at the four corners of her sitting room. There were three other people at her sitting. Mrs. Ormerod from Belsize Park, in a dark green hat that might have been a flower pot in a previous life. Mr. Scroggy, thin and pallid, with bulging, colorless eyes. And Julia Petley from Hair Today. Note, formerly a cut above the rest, formerly main attraction, formerly curl up and die, formerly a snip at the price, formerly Mr. Bryan's Art de Coiffure, formerly Robinson the Barbers, formerly Phone a Car Taxis. End note. The hairdressers on the high street, fresh out of school and convinced that she herself had unplumbed occult depths. In order to enhance the occult aspects of herself, Julia had begun to wear far too much hand-beaten silver jewelry and green eyeshadow. She felt she looked haunted and gaunt and romantic, and she would have, if she had lost another 30 pounds. She was convinced that she was anorexic, because every time she looked in the mirror, she did indeed see a fat person. "Can you link hands?" asked Madame Tracy. "And we must have complete silence. The spirit world is very sensitive to vibration." "Ask if my Ron is there," said Mrs. Ormerod. She had a jaw like a brick. "I will, love, but you've got to be quiet while I make contact." There was silence, broken only by Mr. Scroggy's stomach rumbling. "Pardon, ladies," he mumbled. Madame Tracy had found, through years of drawing aside the veil and exploring the mysteries, that 2 minutes was the right length of time to sit in silence, waiting for the spirit world to make contact. More than that, and they got restive. Less than that, and they felt they weren't getting their money's worth. She did her shopping list in her head. Eggs, lettuce, ounce of cooking cheese, 4 tomatoes, butter, roll of toilet paper. Mustn't forget that, we're nearly out. And a really nice piece of liver for Mr. Shadwell, poor old soul. It's a shame. Time. Madame Tracy threw back her head, let it loll on one shoulder, then slowly lifted it again. Her eyes were almost shut.
"She's going under now, dear,"
she heard Mrs. Ormerod whisper to Julia Petley.
"Nothing to be alarmed about. She's just making herself a bridge to the other side. Her spirit guide will be along soon."
Madame Tracy found herself rather irritated at being upstaged, and she let out a low moan. "Oh!" Then, in a high-pitched, quavery voice,
"Are you there, my spirit guide?"
She waited a little to build up the suspense. Washing up liquid, 2 cans of baked beans, oh, and potatoes.
"How?" she said in a dark brown voice.
"Is that you, Geronimo?"
she asked herself.
"Is a me, how?" she replied.
"We have a new member of the circle with us this afternoon," she said.
"How, Miss Petley?" she said as Geronimo.
She had always understood that Red Indian spirit guides were an essential prop, and she rather liked the name. She had explained this to Newt. She didn't know anything about Geronimo, he realized, and he didn't have the heart to tell her.
"Oh!" squeaked Julia. "Charmed to make your acquaintance." "Is my Ron there, Geronimo?"
asked Mrs. Ormerod.
"How, Squaw Barrel?" said Madame Tracy. "Oh, there are so many of the poor lost souls lined up against door to my teepee. Perhaps your Ron is amongst them. How?
Madam Tracy had learned her lesson years earlier, and now never brought Ron through until near the end. If she didn't, Beryl Ormerod would occupy the rest of the seance telling the late Ron Ormerod everything that had happened to her since their last little chat.
And now, Ron, you remember our Eric's littlest, Sibylla? Well, you wouldn't recognize her now. She's taken up macrame. And our Letitia, you know, our Karen's oldest, she's become a lesbian, but that's all right these days, and is doing a dissertation on the films of Sergio Leone, as seen from a feminist perspective. And our Stan, you know, our Sandra's twin, I told you about him last time. Well, he won the darts tournament, which is nice because we all thought he was a bit of a mother's boy. While the guttering over the shed's come loose, but I spoke to our Cindy's latest, who's a jobbing builder, and he'll be over to see it on Sunday. And, oh, that reminds me.
No, Beryl Ormerod could wait. There was a flash of lightning, followed almost immediately by a rumble of distant thunder. Madam Tracy felt rather proud, as if she had done it herself. It was even better than the candles at creating ambulance. Ambulance was what mediuming was all about. Now, said Madam Tracy in her own voice, Mr. Geronimo would like to know, is there anyone named Mr. Scroggy here? Scroggy's watery eyes gleamed.
Actually, that's my name, he said hopefully.
Right. Well, there's somebody here for you. Mr. Scroggy had been coming for a month now, and she hadn't been able to think of a message for him. His time had come.
Do you know anyone named, John?
No,
said Mr. Scroggy.
Well, there's some celestial interference here. The name could be Tom, or Jim, or, Dave. I knew a Dave when I was in Hemel Hempstead,
said Mr. Scroggy a trifle doubtfully.
Yes, he's saying Hemel Hempstead. That's what he's saying, said Madam Tracy. But I ran into him last week, walking his dog, and he looked perfectly healthy,
said Mr. Scroggy, slightly puzzled.
He says not to worry, and he's happier beyond the veil, soldiered on Madam Tracy, who felt it was always better to give her clients good news. Tell my Ron I've got to tell him about our Crystal's wedding, said Mrs. Ormerod.
I will, love. Now, hold on a mo, there's something coming through. And then something came through. It sat in Madam Tracy's head and peered out.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch,
it said, using Madam Tracy's mouth.
Parlez-vous français? Wo bu oui zhang zong wen? Is that you, Ron?
Asked Mrs. Ormerod. The reply, when it came, was rather testy.
No, definitely not. However, a question so manifestly dim can only have been put in one country on this benighted planet, most of which, incidentally, I have seen during the last few hours. Dear lady, this is not Ron.
Well, I want to speak to Ron Ormerod, said Mrs. Ormerod, a little testily. He's rather short, balding on top. Can you put him on, please?
There was a pause.
Actually, there does appear to be a spirit of that description hovering over here. Very well. I'll hand you over, but you must make it quick. I am attempting to avert the apocalypse.
Mrs. Ormerod and Mr. Scroggy gave each other looks. Nothing like this had happened at Madam Tracy's previous settings. Julia Petley was rapt. This was more like it. She hoped Madam Tracy was going to start manifesting ectoplasm next.
Hello?
Said Madam Tracy in another voice. Mrs. Ormerod started. It sounded exactly like Ron. On previous occasions, Ron had sounded like Madam Tracy.
Ron, is that you?
Yes, Beryl.
Right. Now, I've quite a bit to tell you. For a start, I went to our Crystal's wedding last Saturday, our Marilyn's eldest.
But, Beryl, you never let me get a word in edgewise while I was alive. Now I'm dead. There's just one thing to say.
Beryl Ormerod was a little disgruntled by all this. Previously, when Ron had manifested, he had told her that he was happier beyond the veil, and living somewhere that sounded more than a little like a celestial bungalow. Now he sounded like Ron, and she wasn't sure that was what she wanted. And she said what she had always said to her husband when he began to speak to her in that tone of voice.
Ron, remember your heart condition.
I don't have a heart any longer, remember? Anyway, but Beryl.
Yes, Ron.
Shut up.
And the spirit was gone.
Wasn't that touching? Right. Now, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm afraid I shall have to be getting on.
Madam Tracy stood up, went over to the door, and turned on the lights.
Out,
she said. Her sitters stood up, more than a little puzzled, and, in Mrs. Ormerod's case, outraged, and they walked out into the hall.
You haven't heard the last of this, Marjorie Potts,
hissed Mrs. Ormerod, clutching her handbag to her breast, and she slammed the door. Then her muffled voice echoed from the hallway.
And you can tell our Ron that he hasn't heard the last of this either.
Madam Tracy, and the name on her scooters-only driving license, was indeed Marjorie Potts, went into the kitchen and turned off the sprouts. She put on the kettle. She made herself a pot of tea. She sat down at the kitchen table, got out two cups, filled both of them. She added two sugars to one of them. Then she paused.
No sugar for me, please, said Madam Tracy.
She lined up the cups on the table in front of her and took a long sip from the tea with sugar. Now, she said, in a voice that anyone who knew her would have recognized as her own, although they might not have recognized her tone of voice, which was cold with rage.
Suppose you tell me what this is about, and it had better be good.
A lorry had shed its load all over the M6. According to its manifest, the lorry had been filled with sheets of corrugated iron, although the two police patrolmen were having difficulty in accepting this.
So what I want to know is, where did all the fish come from? Asked the sergeant. I told you, they fell from the sky. One minute I'm driving along at 60, next second, whap, a 12-pound salmon smashes through the windscreen. So I pulls the wheel over and I skidded on that. He pointed to the remains of a hammerhead shark under the lorry. And ran into that.
That was a 30-foot-high heap of fish, of different shapes and sizes.
Have you been drinking, sir? Asked the sergeant, less than hopefully.
Course I haven't been drinking, you great wazook. You can see the fish, can't you?
On the top of the pile, a rather large octopus waved a languid tentacle at them. The sergeant resisted the temptation to wave back. The police constable was leaning into the police car, talking on the radio.
Corrugated iron and fish blocking off the southbound M6, about half a mile north of Junction 10. We're going to have to close off the whole southbound carriageway.
Yeah.
The rain redoubled. The small trout, which had miraculously survived the fall, gamely began to swim toward Birmingham.
That was wonderful, said Newt.
Good, said Anathema. The earth moved for everybody. She got up off the floor, leaving her clothes scattered across the carpet, and went into the bathroom. Newt raised his voice.
I mean, it was really wonderful. Really, really wonderful.
I always hoped it was going to be, and it was.
There was the sound of running water.
What are you doing?
He asked.
Taking a shower?
Ah. He wondered vaguely if everyone had to shower afterwards, or if it was just women. And he had a suspicion that bidets came into it somewhere.
Tell you what,
said Newt, as Anathema came out of the bathroom, swathed in a fluffy pink towel.
We could do it again.
Nope, she said. Not now. She finished drying herself and started picking up clothes from the floor, and unself-consciously pulling them on. Newt, a man who was prepared to wait half an hour for a free changing cubicle at the swimming baths, rather than face the possibility of having to disrobe in front of another human being, found himself vaguely shocked and deeply thrilled. Bits of her kept appearing and disappearing, like a conjurer's hands. Newt kept trying to count her nipples and failing, although he didn't mind.
Why not? Said Newt.
He was about to point out that it might not take long, but an inner voice counseled him against it. He was growing up quite quickly in a short time. Anathema shrugged. Not an easy move when you're pulling on a sensible black skirt. She said we only did it this once. Newt opened his mouth two or three times, then said,
She didn't. She bloody didn't. She couldn't predict that. I don't believe it.
Anathema, fully dressed, walked over to her card index, pulled one out, and passed it to him.